This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Welcome to Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. How can you remain positive with all the bad news out there? If you're watching what's happening in America today, you're seeing epic scale deceit and corruption and lawlessness, and it's really shocking. It can be rather depressing. I'm going to share a New York Times article with you about some of the people being victimized by pornography that will bring you to tears. But we're going to look at the solution to problems like this one. And there are so many of them besieging our world today, but there are solutions. And it really is something that can help you to put the grief that you experience over this kind of news in its proper context. We're going to look at how news like this really should motivate our spiritual lives. Later in the show, we're going to look at the link between Iran and Al-Qaeda. This is a link that some observers deny. They say these two groups are opposed to one another by religious differences. But Watch Jerusalem assistant managing editor Brent Noctegal is going to give us a report showing that they are linked, and this is entirely consistent with biblical prophecy. We'll also talk about what the coronavirus lockdowns are doing to our young people. These lockdowns are getting more stringent. They're shutting down a lot of schools, or at least forcing students to do distance learning at home. We're going to hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about what this is doing to our children's education. And finally, I have a few words to you husbands about what to do when your wife is discouraged. Let's start, though, with a look at the child victims of pornography. In the Sunday Review section of the New York Times this past week was an article by Nicholas Kristof about one popular porn website, which attracts 3.5 billion visits a month, more than Netflix, Yahoo, or Amazon. One ranking lists it as the 10th most visited website in the world. And this report says that among all the sick and perverted material on this website, there's a lot of explicit video taken without consent of the participants. And that includes loads of videos of children. Children being abused. This is what Kristof wrote in this article. After a 15-year-old girl went missing in Florida, her mother found her on this website in 58 sex videos. Sexual assaults on a 14-year-old California girl were posted there and were reported to the authorities, not by the company, but by a classmate who saw the videos. In each case, offenders were arrested for the assaults, but this company escaped responsibility for sharing the videos and profiting from them. Now, this company says that it works really hard to keep this kind of material off its website, but this Times author says the site still has oceans of this material. This author writes, "This website is like YouTube in that it allows members of the public to post their own videos. A great majority of the 6.8 million new videos posted on the site each year probably involve consenting adults, but many depict child abuse and non-consensual violence. Because it's impossible to be sure whether a youth in a video is 14 or 18, neither the company nor anyone else has a clear idea of how much content is illegal." So this isn't even addressing what kind of toxic filth this website posts among people who consent to post that material there. This is only talking about what is very explicitly illegal, simply because the people in the video are underaged. This article says, unlike YouTube, this site allows these videos to be downloaded directly from its website. So even if a rape video is removed at the request of the authorities, it may already be too late. The video lives on as it is shared with others or uploaded again and again. One woman told this New York Times author that, quote, she was adopted in the United States from China and then trafficked by her adoptive family and forced to appear in videos beginning when she was 9 years old. Some videos of her being abused ended up on this site and regularly reappear there, she said. And this author talks about high school and even junior high school girls who get pressured, say, to send a video to a boyfriend, and then that video ends up on this website and it gets spread everywhere. And many of these girls turn to drug addiction. Many of them become suicidal because of the damage that it has done, the permanent damage to their reputation. He quotes a Colombian teenager that didn't want her name revealed, saying, "They're making money off the worst moment in my life." It's a powerful example of the appalling and deadly effects of sin. People want to pretend like pornography is about freedom, that it's healthy, that it's liberating, that it's liberating to women. These are the real fruits. Jesus Christ said, "Whosoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart." So it breaks the Ten Commandments. It breaks the law of God. It is sin. And Christ continued, "If your right eye offend you, pluck it out and cast it from you, for it is profitable for you that one of your members should perish and not that your whole body should be cast into hell." You can read that in Matthew 5. The wages of sin is death. And before you die from it, you experience all sorts of other curses and evils because of its presence in your life. What this one company is doing to people's lives is a vivid example. This article says one study this year by a digital marketing company concluded that this company was the technology company with the third greatest impact on society in the 21st century, after Facebook and Google, but ahead of Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon. This is a huge company, a very influential company. But then, as this article brings out, the problem goes far beyond one company. Depictions of child abuse also appear on mainstream sites like Twitter, Reddit, and Facebook. And Google supports the business models of companies that thrive on child molestation. It's hard to even wrap your mind around what is happening here. This author says he asked the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to compile the number of images, videos, and other content related to child sexual exploitation reported to it each year. In 2015, just 5 years ago, it received reports of 6.5 million videos or other files. In 2017, just 2 years later, 20.6 million. That's over three times as much. And then in 2019, 69.2 million. Just 2 years after that. The demand for this kind of deranged content is exploding. This is people watching video of people being abused and unspeakable things being done to them. And the demand is just growing and growing, and that's because it's addictive. And people are becoming enslaved by it. As Jesus Christ said in John 8:34, "Most assuredly I say to you, whosoever commits sin is a slave of sin." 2 Peter 2:19 says, "Whatever overcomes a man, to that he is enslaved." That is a despicable kind of slavery that is taking place. But on top of that, you have people literally being enslaved by pornography, drawn into the world of human trafficking and being bought and sold literally as slaves. Here are just a couple of statistics from an infographic that we had in our February 2014 Trumpet issue. 2.8 million children in America run away from home each year. Within 48 hours, one-third of them are picked up by traffickers and pimps. 100,000 to 300,000 children in the United States are enslaved in sex trafficking every year. The average age of entry into prostitution in the U.S. is ages 12 to 14. On top of that, 30% of all the data transferred across the internet is pornography. And 20% of all internet pornography involves trafficked children. This is an incomprehensibly massive problem. And this world has no solutions to this problem. And really, if you look through human history, you see that this kind of exploitation has been taking place all through history. It's worse now because technology makes it possible for this to spread so quickly and so strongly. But really, efforts to stamp out these kinds of problems have been going on throughout history, and they haven't proven sufficient because human nature is so evil and it's so pernicious. The International Labor Organization, the ILO, estimates that 45.8 million people in 167 countries around the world are currently enslaved. That's more than three times the total number of Africans who were shipped to the Americas during the entire 360-year history of the slave trade in the New World. The ILO estimates that annual profits from forced labor are around $150 billion. So that's bigger than Google. It's bigger than big oil. It's bigger than the U.S. banking system. It's the third largest criminal industry in the world behind drugs and weapons trafficking. Now, this New York Times article advocated that credit card companies stop accepting payments to this one website. And Axios did a little story saying, Nick Kristof gets results. Credit card giants Visa and MasterCard said they're reviewing their relationship with this company. Visa said if the company is violating the law or bank policies, the website will be prohibited from accepting Visa. MasterCard promised immediate action if the allegations are substantiated. So this New York Times reporter gets results. Look at those results. But think about this. This problem is absolutely monstrous. And little tweaks like this, a couple of credit card companies saying they won't accept payment, those don't do anything to address the foundational problems of people who are destroying themselves and destroying others because of their addiction to sin. We're talking about one company among who knows how many hundreds or thousands of companies that are serving up this poisonous content to millions upon millions of people and corrupting the minds of men and women and children and destroying marriages and families, twisting people's minds. What's happening in the lives of the handful of young people who appeared in this New York Times story is playing out over and over again in various forms in millions of lives, and people are too addicted to sin to even care about it. And really, this is just one of literally countless ways that people are putting other people through indescribable torment. Indescribable cruelty and tyranny and corruption and thievery. People who are suffering in so many forms in this world. The human mind really can only take in so much. And in this information-saturated age, you hear news of people mistreating their fellow human beings in such a torrent that it can be easy to grow numb to it. And the truth be told, we're helpless to do anything substantive to stop it. These blights on humanity are painfully endemic to the human condition. But there is one being who has seen all of this, who has never succumbed to apathy, and who absolutely will put a stop to it. I'll just read a few verses from the 94th Psalm. It begins, O eternal God, to whom vengeance belongs, O God, to whom vengeance belongs, show yourself, lift up yourself, you judge of the earth, render a reward to the proud. This is a plea with God to exact vengeance on the evil of this world that is so triumphant in far too many cases. It continues, Eternal, how long shall the wicked, how long shall the wicked triumph? That's a question that many, many people have been asking for millennia, seeing the injustice in this world, witnessing wickedness triumph, and asking, how long will this go on? A righteous mind aches to see this kind of injustice and abuse and evil. Verse 6 of Psalm 94 says, they slay the widow and the stranger, they murder the fatherless. Yet they say, the Eternal shall not see, neither shall the God of Jacob regard it. These evil people are abusing the helpless, and they think that God doesn't see. But there's a whole lot to prove that God does, that God sees all of it, and he promises to do something about it. This psalm continues, understand, you brutish among the people and you fools, when will you be wise? He that planted the ear, shall he not hear? He that formed the eye, shall he not see? He that chastises the heathen, shall he not correct? He that teaches man knowledge, shall he not know? The Eternal knows the thoughts of man, that they are vanity. And he shall bring upon them their own iniquity, and shall cut them off in their own wickedness. Yea, the Eternal our God shall cut them off. God is going to step up and judge and correct these evils. When Jesus Christ walked the earth, he witnessed untold human suffering. And he did what he could to alleviate it. He was moved with compassion. He saw the people like sheep having no shepherd. And he brought the good news of a kingdom that would come and uproot the corrupt kingdoms of this world, and that would fulfill the prophecies of the scriptures. Like it says in Psalm 72 and verse 4, he shall judge the poor of the people, and he shall save the children of the needy, and shall break in pieces the oppressor. Jesus Christ continually directed his disciples to seek that kingdom, to press toward it, to set their heart on preparing for that kingdom. And when his disciples asked him how to pray, this is what he said, after this manner therefore pray ye, Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. You can read that in Matthew 6 verses 9 and 10. To this day, Christ's disciples keep these words on our lips. When we see oppression, when we see suffering, when we see immorality spreading and unmentionable evils seizing our cities, when we see minds and bodies of helpless children being abused with impunity, this is what we say, Thy kingdom come. 2 Peter 3:12 admonishes us to be looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God. And the Greek word translated looking for means earnestly waiting for. And the more depraved human behavior becomes, the more earnestly we wait. So even as Christ says, surely I come quickly, we say, like the Apostle John did, to close the words of sacred scripture at the end of the book of Revelation. Amen. Even so, come, Lord Jesus. In his masterful booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like, Herbert Armstrong expounded on the many scriptures that fill the Bible with inspiring descriptions of the utopian world to come, the utopian world that God is going to create. And it is totally refreshing to read. It's a sweet song amid the din and the clamor of this world. You really do owe it to yourself to read it. If you just ask us, we will send you a free copy of this book. But this is what Mr. Armstrong wrote. Feast your eyes for a while on the picture of the world tomorrow, which God's government will produce, as we shall now do. And when you take your eyes from this book and look again on this drab, ugly, sin-sick world of corruption, violence, and suffering, it will make you sick at heart. But doesn't it make you want to shout for joy to realize what a civilization, what a world is actually coming? Doesn't it make you want to really put your heart into your prayers, praying earnestly, oh God, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
How involved is Iran with terrorism? Well, many analysts say there's an unbridgeable divide between the Shiite Islamic Republic and many Sunni Islamic terrorist groups. We'll learn the truth in this report from Brent Noctegal.
On the evening of August 7th, Lebanese professor Habib Dawood was driving his Renault L39 through the bustling streets of Tehran, Iran. In the car with him that night was his 27-year-old daughter, Miriam. As Dawood approached a set of traffic lights, two men on a motorbike pulled up alongside. The rider pulled out a silenced pistol and fired five shots through the window at Dawood and his daughter. The assassin's bullets found their mark. Both Habib and Miriam died immediately. The assailants fled into the night, leaving the bullet-ridden car idling in the road. That killing, back on August 7th, came in tandem with a series of explosions at Iranian nuclear facilities. The murder of a Lebanese academic and his daughter soon faded from the headlines, but not before journalists had a chance to dig into the background of these victims. They found one glaring problem. Habib Dawood didn't exist. Back in Lebanon, nobody had heard of the professor or his daughter. They had no associates, no friends. Then the journalists dug further, and new names emerged for these victims. The man was none other than Abu Muhammad al-Masri, al-Qaeda's second-in-command. For years, al-Masri had sat near the top of the FBI's most wanted list. There was a $10 million reward for information leading to his capture. Al-Masri was responsible for the 1998 U.S. bombings in Kenya and Tanzania of the embassies that left 224 dead. His own death came on the very anniversary of those attacks. His slain daughter was the widow of Osama bin Laden's son, Hamza bin Laden. It seems that she also died for her role in the plots. Now, Iran is no stranger to assassination and spycraft, but what makes this case unusual is the cover-up. Al-Qaeda sat on the news for months, only coming forward to confirm the news in December, and at the time of the assassination, Iran also buried the news and continues to deny the allegations to this day. You see, Iran and Al-Qaeda are not meant to be friends. They're meant to be enemies. Both are radical Islamists, but Iran is Shiite and Al-Qaeda is Sunni. They're meant to be locked into that millennial-old struggle for supremacy over the Muslim world, not working together. But if that's the case, what was Masri, the Al-Qaeda number two, doing in Iran? According to sources that spoke with the New York Times, al-Masri has been in Iranian custody since 2003, but that he had been living freely in the Pasdaran district of Tehran, an upscale suburb, since at least 2015. This was not exactly a prisoner's lifestyle, but not free also from Iranian control. Just how much control over al-Masri Iran had, we might not ever know. But nevertheless, the fact that al-Qaeda's number two was inside Iran and acting relatively freely for such a long time shows that there is a very real connection between the Islamic nation of Iran and al-Qaeda. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo declared back in April 2019, quote, Iran's connections to al-Qaeda are very real. They have hosted al-Qaeda. They permitted al-Qaeda to transit their country. There is no doubt there is a connection between the Islamic Republic of Iran and al-Qaeda, period, full stop, end quote. Now, many in the mainstream media claim that linking al-Qaeda to Iran is baseless. To them, the jihadists and Iranians cannot and will not cooperate. The world views the association between Iran and al-Qaeda to be like oil and water. Iran, Shiite, al-Qaeda, Sunni, each considers the others religious heretics. The only tenuous thread binding the two is a shared hatred of the West. But all of this now is being challenged. The cover-up of al-Misri's murder suggests the relationship is stronger, far stronger, than many are willing to admit. Iran didn't want the world to know about al-Misri working inside of its borders. It was in Iran's best interest to have the world believe that there's no way it could work with Sunni partners. However, the al-Misri killing just shows that to be false once again. The age-old saying says, "The enemy of my enemy is my friend." And Iran's target, first and foremost, is the nation of Israel and its Western supporters like the United States, the great Satan, perpetuating al-Qaeda's existence, even if it's not controlled by the mullahs completely, definitely does help Iran. For instance, earlier this year, the United States signed an agreement with the Afghani Taliban. In the deal, the U.S. would commit to withdrawing all American forces from the country by next summer, and in return, the Taliban would stop al-Qaeda from using Afghanistan to stage attacks. This was a major victory for Iran, though. By perpetuating the war and keeping al-Qaeda alive inside its borders and supporting it across the border into Afghanistan, Iran has worn America out. Al-Qaeda is heavily involved with the Taliban ranks. They will not leave Afghanistan, and even if they did, they would only need to move a few hours away to neighboring Iran. By supporting America's enemies, Iran has been able to wage a proxy war, all without risking a more direct confrontation with the West. But the evidence is piling up of Iran's support for al-Qaeda. Even the Benghazi attacks have ties to al-Qaeda and Iran. In 2013, Egypt arrested three militants armed with explosives and bomb-making equipment. Egypt's Interior Minister Mohamed Ibrahim told journalists that the men received orders from an al-Qaeda leader called Daoud al-Assadi. According to Rewards for Justice, a website set up by the United States State Department, al-Assadi is an alias for Mushin al-Fadli, who was the leader of al-Qaeda in Iran. One of the three terrorists even received military training inside Iran. There are also other al-Qaeda affiliates, such as al-Shabaab, that operate out of Somalia, that also have very strong links to Iran. Many of its fighters have received advanced training from Hezbollah, an arm of the Iranians. The evidence is piling up, and it's there for all to see, yet so few do. Trumpet editor-in-chief Mr. Gerald Flory wrote back in 2006 that America lacks the will to confront Iran, the head of the terrorist-sponsoring snake. Instead, the United States has gone after wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and elsewhere to chop off the snake's tail. But there is simply no denying that Iran is at the head of all of it. Accepting these facts is hard. Doing so means that Iran's influence is far broader than most are willing to accept. If Iran and al-Qaeda are working together, how far does it extend? How much responsibility must be laid at the feet of Iran for Benghazi or 9/11? If al-Qaeda can work with Iran in these areas, where else do they cooperate? Only time may tell. Iran's efforts to spread terror across the Middle East and North Africa are being exposed. Iran once hid behind, comfortably, its proxies. Today, we are starting to see Iran for what it is. It's not a Shiite-exclusive enabler. Iran is an active instigator of terrorism through any means possible, Sunni or Shia. And this means it'd be more than willing to partner up with al-Qaeda. Much of the world is only now waking up to Iran's involvement in the region. But the trumpet has forecast the rise and ruin of the Iranian regime for decades. We see Iran as becoming a major power in North Africa. It will get control of Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. Its links with Al-Qaeda and her affiliates in these places, including the Muslim Brotherhood, are a major step in that direction. These terrorist groups operating in Northeast Africa may be Sunni, but they are still influenced by Iran and supported by Iran. And as Al-Masri's life in Tehran suggests, that support may go deeper than previously thought. The Middle East is currently being divided up into two camps. It's not camps of Sunni and Shiites, as we've been told for decades it would be. It's the camp of the radicals, and then the rest. And that radical Islamist camp, no matter whether Sunni or Shiite, is led by Iran.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. It's pretty chilling to be talking about this in the context of everything that's been happening with Iran lately. We talked about how they have come out into the fore much more openly, exposing their intent to get nuclear weapons in the face of a Biden administration. You had the arms embargo lifted recently that enables other countries to trade arms with Iran. Definitely some indications of Iran being on the ascendancy, just kind of remarkable. And I think this analysis that Iran is not connected to any of these openly terrorist groups, it's very much the kind of thinking that motivated the Obama presidency and the, I guess, very much Biden's way of thinking and looking at Iran as they're trying to cobble back together this the Iran nuclear deal. But the evidence is just clearer all the time that that's a fundamentally flawed way of viewing Iran.
Yeah, and there's been a campaign for over the past decade to try and belittle Iran's terrorist activity against the United States, because, I mean, that's very obvious for people to see. You can see a terrorist attack, people are killed, and linking that back to a source, and especially when American deaths are involved. And with a nuclear program, a nuclear deal, people can accept, okay, we could accept a deal on the nuclear program because it'll stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. It's very far away. But when you start pinning Iran on deaths of American servicemen in Afghanistan, deaths of American servicemen through terrorist proxies inside Iraq, like we know has happened during the Iraq war, over 600 U.S. servicemen were killed by Iranian terrorists, Iranian-backed terrorists inside Iraq, or even what they've done to fund al-Qaeda's existence inside Afghanistan to perpetuate a war against the United States there. Those things really irk the United States population, and for good reason. So you had this massive policy by the Obama administration to show Iran as somebody that we can do a negotiation, a deal with. So they had to hide and belittle these links to outward terrorist organizations, very open terrorist organizations that had American blood on their hands. And that's what they've done for years with al-Qaeda as well. The Obama administration did not want to link Iran and al-Qaeda because al-Qaeda took down the trade centers. And so they've got to be separate. And so there has been this massive information campaign that belittles or undermines Iran's true connections to rogue terrorist organizations like al-Qaeda, al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, Libyan factions, Iraqi factions, Syrian factions, because it's obvious that we shouldn't do a deal with those bad guys in Iran, because look at all the terrorist activity they're funding everywhere. But as you say, this administration has sought to blow the cover off that. Mm-hmm. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has done a lot to try and say that they see Iran and al-Qaeda working hand in hand. Yes, they will have differences of approaches, differences of targets. They might attack each other every now and then, as you'd expect. However, when it comes to violent acts perpetrated against the West, Iran is fully in line with the way that al-Qaeda works in that way.
This is another example of just how the perspective provided by Bible prophecy is so useful And going back and looking at what our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has been saying about Iran and its support for terrorist activity throughout the region for decades now, really does provide clarity. And you see the facts that have come out in recent years really backing up what he's been saying all along.
Yeah, and you can go back to 2001, the article that he wrote on the heels of the trade centers going down and the American intervention in Afghanistan. And he said, while that might be a good place to start in terms of, yes, that's where the attack was launched from, if you don't deal with the head of the terrorist state, Iran, this terrorist problem is going to stick around. And that's what he said back in 2001. And that was informed by biblical prophecies written 1,000 years earlier, which talk about how Iran is going to lead a radical Islamic – well, it talks about how Iran is going to lead the king – there's going to be a king of the south in the time of the end that has a policy of push – a very provocative foreign policy that makes other nations act. And Mr. Fleury, for 30 years now, has said, well, that's Iran, and that's radical Islam led by Iran. It's not radical Shiites led by Iran, because Iran's a Shiite nation. It's all the radical Islamist camp is going to come under the Iranian regime. That's what the biblical prophecy says. That prophecy found in Daniel 11, verse 40 to 45, mentions nations allied with Iran. And those nations, Egypt, Libya, probably Sudani region going down to Ethiopia, the version of Islam they follow is not Shia. That's Sunni. And so based on that, we know that there is going to be a wedding between Sunni and Shia under the umbrella of the radical element of those religions. And that is not an analysis you've seen that people have accepted, broadly speaking, over the past 30 years. It's been our analysis based on biblical prophecy, but now we're seeing that happen. We're seeing that cover be blown off, especially as the Saudis and other heads of these massive Muslim nations go a bit more moderate and try to not kind of divorce themselves from some of their more radical elements within their kingdoms, like Al-Qaeda. The radicals are going to have to find a home somewhere. They're going to have to find a source of funding, state funding somewhere, and they're going to be pushed even further into Iran's camp because of that as well. And so going forward, yes, there should be more evidence coming forward to show that Iran is in bed with the big Sunni radicals such as Al-Qaeda, but even the Muslim Brotherhood, a big Sunni organization as well.
And Bible prophecy has a whole lot to say about that relationship as well. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the links between the Shiite Islamic Republic of Iran and Sunni Islamic terrorist groups. We have an article about this subject up at thetrumpet.com today by Callum Wood, Iran and Al-Qaeda, Friend or Foe. Go check that out. Thanks very much for your time, Brent.
Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
With all the coronavirus restrictions, what is happening to our children's education? We'll get some answers in this report from Andrew Miller.
Most American students are falling short in math, and COVID-19 lockdowns are making the problem worse. That is the finding of a November NWEA analysis of 4.4 million students in grades 3 through 8. When U.S. schools closed in the spring, 55 million students were thrown into unfamiliar ways of learning. They were forced to stay home, away from the support schools provide students. Those without internet access were cut off from teachers, while those with internet access still struggled in a less structured environment. The result is that students who took an NWEA mathematics test scored, on average, 5 to 10 percentile points behind students who took the same test last year. And the negative effects of remote learning are even worse amongst Black and Hispanic students. While most students scored reading comprehension levels similar to non-pandemic years, this was not true of Black or Hispanic students. They saw declines in their reading grades, suggesting that lockdowns are exacerbating existing racial and socioeconomic disparities. A separate study by McKinsey and Company estimates that COVID-19 lockdowns have set white students back by 1 to 3 months in math, but have set students of color back by 3 to 5 months. Educational experts say high-intensity tutoring and summer school programs will be needed to repair the damage caused by the COVID-19 lockdowns. But the McKinsey & Company study estimates that such measures will cost at least $66 billion, $2,500 per student. One teacher in South Carolina reported in May that 15% of her students were not turning in homework during the lockdown, even though she had been able to keep contact with them. This infers that many students are simply refusing to study outside the classroom, even if they have internet access at home. And since many households do not have a stay-at-home parent, many students are without any supervision. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development reports that more students are doing homework online during the pandemic, but that unsupervised internet access is also increasing exposure to cyberbullying, scary news stories, and pornographic pop-up ads. The former Education Secretary John King Jr. told the Washington Post, "I think we should be very concerned about the risk of the loss of an entire generation of students." The harm COVID-19 lockdowns have done to school children is tragic. But what may be even more tragic is that these lockdowns were completely unnecessary. Since COVID-19 is a disease that primarily threatens the elderly, very few school-aged children have died from it. Most European nations have made keeping schools open a priority. Yet the U.S. has put 55 million students in a situation that has hurt their education. According to a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, Nat Malkus, "We should have the vast majority of elementary school students back in school. We are still bleeding, so the first thing to do is to stop the bleeding, and then we're going to have some healing to do, and it's going to take years." Even before the COVID-19 pandemic, the U.S. ranked near the bottom of a list of 35 industrialized nations in math education. And America's current draconian response to COVID-19 is likely to make the situation much, much worse. The Bible instructs people to quarantine their sick, but America's public health officials have hurt an entire generation of students by quarantining nearly 55 million healthy school children. The nation will suffer from the effects of this dreadful decision for years to come as students struggle to learn mathematics and reading. The prophet Isaiah said in Isaiah chapter 10, verses 1 through 3, "Woe to them that decree unrighteous decrees and that write grievousness which they have prescribed, to turn aside the needy from judgment and to take away the right from the poor of thy people. The widows may be their prey and they may rob the fatherless." Now, stoking COVID-19 panic among voters may help Democratic politicians with an incentive to weaken President Trump's economy, but it hurts America's most vulnerable school children. Thomas Jefferson once said, "If a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be." Yet the politicians trying to restrict people's freedom today are dumbing down American students.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. It is an aspect of all of these lockdowns that isn't receiving a whole lot of attention. It seems like those politicians who are so enthusiastic about all of these lockdowns don't really pay a whole lot of attention to the ripple effects that those measures are having. But you look at these young people, really you've got two groups and problems with each of them, I suppose. There are quite a few kids that don't have internet access, and so they're not even able to access the education that is available online. But the other, and you kind of alluded to this in your report, is those who do have internet access, they're not necessarily using that purely for scholastic purposes. There's all kinds of trouble that they can get into when they're on the internet unsupervised.
Right. Yeah, this definitely is the two groups. And as I brought out in the report, it seemed like that's a lot of the reason that the Black and Hispanic children were doing more poorly is because a lot of them were from poorer neighborhoods where they just didn't have a computer or access to the internet or home to participate in the remote learning programs being made available. But then as the other report noted, that you've got a lot of families where both parents, they may have a computer at home and internet access at home, but both parents work. And so their schools closed down, their kids are on lockdown. They're just like, all right, well, we're both to work. It's like, you know where the computer is, do your homework. But without a teacher or a school official or an engaged parent in the room, some of them are getting involved in all sorts of activities. There's been report after report after report about pornography usage in the United States going up, not just among school children, but like overall, because right. There's just so many people who are who normally be either at school or at work or at the gym or at a restaurant or at all sorts of other places that they can't be at right now. And so you're just stuck in the house with a computer, getting into all sorts of things you shouldn't be getting involved in. But that's especially for, like they said, these school age students at a vulnerable time of life. They're getting some like deep mental scars,
right,
being developed when they should be doing homework.
Yeah, this is just one more effect of the coronavirus and the lockdowns that will probably have effects that will stretch out for years to come. It'll be it's untold damage that is being done. We really don't know, and we won't know for quite some time, just how much of that is being done. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about some of the problems resulting from coronavirus lockdowns on American schools. He has an article he's working on that will appear on thetrumpet.com very soon. You can watch for that. Thank you for your time, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
The words felt foreign as they slipped from my lips. Sweetie, I just want you to know that I love you. I have no problem with your being emotional right now. I understand why you're upset. Normally, when my wife is upset about something that doesn't seem particularly worth getting upset over, I would react by saying something like, "You shouldn't feel that way. Aren't you overreacting? It seems like you should apologize to that person. Why are you mad at me? I didn't do anything wrong." I instinctively reach for explanations and answers, or even trying to solve the problem as instantaneously as possible. Needless to say, it never works. But amazingly, what I did in this case did work. The distress on my wife's face instantly melted into relief, a smile even. She reached out for a hug. It seemed all the pain had just about vanished in a moment. Dr. Edith Munger says part of our difficulty is that we think we have to have answers for every problem our spouses raise. Actually, a personal relationship is not predicated on solutions to problems or answers to questions. Our top goal should be to understand each other, to get close to each other. When my wife shared her hurt with me, she wasn't looking for solutions. She certainly wasn't inviting my judgment. She was just trying to make a connection. Of course, sometimes when a wife is discouraged or upset, she may need her husband to help her set her thinking straight. Sometimes she does need his problem-solving ability. But virtually all the time, maybe not in every single instance, but almost, even when she needs those other things too, I'm convinced what she needs first, and often solely, is encouragement. There's a beautiful spiritual dimension to this dynamic within a marriage. The marital bond pictures the relationship between Jesus Christ and his people. You can see this described in Ephesians chapter 5. And a husband encouraging his wife points to Jesus Christ doing that for us. 1 John 2 and verse 1 says that when we sin, Jesus Christ becomes our advocate. That word also means encourager. The Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, commented on this verse in his book, The Last Hour. He wrote, "How often do you husbands see your wife down and depressed, and you know she needs your encouragement? A righteous husband will be there for his wife." That's what Jesus Christ does for his wife. When his people are discouraged, Christ doesn't make us feel judged or condemned. He's actually doubling his efforts to encourage us and to set us back on our feet. God's love is so multidimensional. God hates sin passionately, and he recognizes our wrong emotions, and he knows that we need to grow up and get rid of them. But at the same time, even in our worst state, his love for us never diminishes. When we're down, especially when it's obviously because of our own sin, wouldn't we be far less inclined to seek God out if all we got from him was cold belittlement or condemnation? But there's tremendous comfort in knowing that when our emotions are out of kilter, we can kneel before God and seek that spiritual connection. We can unburden ourselves. We can talk through our conflicted thoughts, lay bare our weaknesses, and trust that our advocate and encourager will somehow make sense of it all. Romans 8, verse 26 says, "The Spirit helps our infirmities, for we know not what we should pray for as we ought, but the Spirit itself makes intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered." There's really no better tool for getting our emotions back into balance. These kinds of prayers help us anchor ourselves to God and his loving, calming, stabilizing presence. We can always draw on his encouragement. And then once we're closer to being right in our thinking, if necessary, God will give us the answers or the correction that we need. Mr. Fleury wrote this, "Our physical marriages are a type of our marriage to Christ. We must strive to pattern our physical marriages after Christ's marriage to the church. Only then are we fulfilling the God-ordained purpose of marriage." Only then, only as we husbands consider his example as a husband and really endeavor to emulate that. Christ's role as our encourager illustrates his love, his concern, his patience, his commitment, and his determination to understand and embrace every individual whom his Father has selected for his bride, probably better than anything else you could name. Emulate him. Be your wife's encourager. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on the program for today to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal and Andrew Miller. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. "Love does not consist in gazing at each other, but in looking outward together in the same direction." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.